You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of May 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's show:
at no time were intelligence sources or methods discussed, and the president did not disclose any military operations that were not already publicly known.
Unless he did, the day after his national security advisor and others kind of deny that President Donald Trump gave classified intel to the Russians, Trump kind of confirms that he did. My guests Robin Lustig and Michael Goldfarb will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including the murder of Mexican journalist Javier Valdez. Why has his country become such a dangerous one to report in? The peculiar scapegoating of the avocado, and remember this.
My judgment as Prime Minister is that this threat is real, growing, and of an entirely different nature to any conventional threat to our security that Britain has faced before.
The latest on the attempts to bring Britain's former Prime Minister Tony Blair to book over the invasion of Iraq. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Robin Lustig, the journalist and former presenter of BBC Radio 4's The World Tonight, and Michael Goldfarb, the veteran journalist and broadcaster. Welcome both. Now, first of all, not for the first, nor one suspects the last time, it is hard to know which is weirder, the weird thing that President Donald Trump has done, or the fact that the weird thing, which under normal circumstances would seem about the weirdest thing you'd ever heard of, does not, in the current context, actually seem all that weird. Yesterday, various Trump surrogates, including his Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, more or less denied reports that Trump had leaked code word classified material to Russia's foreign minister. Today, Trump more or less confirmed them. Robin, first of all, on balance, what do we think has actually happened? Specifically, what took place in the Oval Office when President Trump hosted Sergei Lavrov?
First thing I have to say is I wasn't there. So I can't speak with absolute authority.
You're surprised about that.
Yeah, I wish I had been. To use your word, whatever it was weird. It was seriously weird. What is being reported is that he said something to Mr. Lavrov about why America is getting concerned about laptop computers and e-readers in the cabins of aircraft to do with IS operatives supposedly learning how to put bombs in them. And it would appear, from what has been reported, that what he said would have given the Russians a pretty good clue as to who was passing on this information and possibly even how. Mr. Trump says he didn't, or rather others of his administration say he didn't pass on any modalities or any military operations, but he said more than the intelligence people were happy with.
Michael, the latest on this is that Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, has given a press conference. What were your thoughts? Because he didn't, again, he trod very carefully between denying that any of this actually happened and outright justifying whatever it was that did.
Yeah, well, he's parsing his words very carefully.
As you would.
Last night, when he was sent out, after the Washington Post published this story, he actually said, it is not true, comma, as reported, which had the entire Washington press corps going, aha, I did not have sexual relations with that woman, but I might have had sexual contact, you know, all of these things.
We are in the realm of it depends what your definition of is.
Non-denial.
And then he came out today and said, what was passed on was wholly appropriate. He was asked directly. This happened a short while ago. And after President Trump had tweeted and basically contradicted him. He said, it's wholly appropriate. He was asked several times, is this... was it classified information or non-classified? I won't get into speculating on what's classified or non-classified. Did it come from another country? The president wouldn't have known. He actually said that. I thought, my God. We know that Donald Trump is an incurious fellow, but when he's getting his daily briefing from General McMaster and is passed along code... What is
code word classified? It's no small change. This is a rung up from top secret.
Exactly right. code word classified from a Middle Eastern ally, unnamed in the Washington Post story. I can think of two.
He was significantly perhaps due to speak today to King Abdullah of Jordan, though the White House is insisting that that was pre-planned.
Haaretz has been reporting for months now that Israeli security people are telling their colleagues in the CIA, don't tell him anything. I mean, it could be any one of these things. Anyway, McMaster ducked and dived and didn't give us any more deep knowledge, except that the information was leaked. He listed three other people who were in the room with Sergei Lavrov and President Trump. He was one of them. Rex Tillerson was another, and a deputy secretary of state was the third. So if it got leaked by an eyewitness, it's one of those three guys. It is a phenomenal thing.
You run out of ways to sort of say that this is bizarre and makes no sense.
But you know
whatsoever.
What's really terrifying, Andrew? What really keeps me awake about this is I am convinced that Mr. Trump doesn't actually know whether what he's doing is okay or not. He doesn't know whether this stuff is code word classified or not. He's just trying to tell Mr. Lavrov, I know things that are really interesting because this is what my intel people have told me. And hey, you might find it interesting as well. And even this morning when he woke up and started tweeting, I'm perfectly entitled to tell them stuff if it helps them fight terrorism. He doesn't seem to have understood why his entire intelligence community, by all accounts, are absolutely hopping mad.
On that subject, Michael, where are you on what is, I think, becoming the defining question of Trump's presidency? On the spectrum between absolutely paid for in the tank Russian stooge, and at the other end of that spectrum, just a complete idiot who has, by appalling happenstance, been promoted several miles out of his depth. Where do you think we are on that spectrum?
Promoted by the American people.
Well, indeed.
Remember that. The popular vote went against him, but there's no sense that he won the election illegally, even with a little bit of Russian intel thumb on the scale. I think people understand that he's an idiot. But the thing is that he's not an unclever idiot. One of his best lines during the campaign was, I don't think it's a bad thing to have better relations with Russia. This is a very, very clever line. And his people, the 36% of the unswayable American public who voted for him and will not walk away from him and will show no buyer's remorse, probably still buy that line.
But Michael, he is old enough to remember what happened to Richard Nixon.
I would be unsurprised to discover that if you actually asked him to sit down and explain what happened to Richard Nixon, he has no meaningful idea at all.
That is possible. That is also quite frightening, if that is indeed the case. But I mean, my point is simply this. If a president incurs the undying enmity of his intelligence advisers, the FBI and the CIA in this case, he is going to be leaked against. He is going to be leaked against day after day after day because they think he is a danger and they want him out. Now, we may or may not think it's a good thing for intelligence operatives to try and influence who the elected head of state is of a particular country, but that's what's happening. And it seems that he has not yet grasped that that's what he's doing.
Just a final thought on this subject from you, Michael. How much sympathy do you have for the likes of General McMaster, Rex Tillerson, and others who day in, day out have to go out and try to put a grown-up face on this? Should they start making decisions about the fact that somebody at some point has to say, this is just utterly untenable and it cannot go on? Or are they kind of bound to where they are by the appalling thought of what they might be replaced with if they left?
Well, I think that you just answered the question as you've asked it, Andrew. I know General McMaster's reputation from his time in Iraq, actually, and people I know served under him in Baghdad. And the thing is that he didn't go into this with closed eyes. He didn't say, I've just been summoned to a high, you know, to yet a higher level of service. He knew exactly what he was getting into. And I think he's probably now in that chamber of horrors moment where you think, exactly as you said, if I leave, it will be worse. At least on the inside, I can still exert some influence. And I'm also learning things for that moment when I think we all sit around this table, I think virtually everyone listening, even people who voted Republican, will know that at some point he will go. It is unsustainable for the world as it is. And, you know, this is the crisis moment. You know, what's happening domestically? The Republicans are quite happy with it. The Republican voters are quite happy with it. The danger has always been, which will happen first? A global crisis, an ISIS actually having a successful mission again, Al-Qaeda having a successful mission, and he's still in office, or he's gone, and we have some more sensible people running America.
Well, on that happy thought, let's move along slightly. 6 years ago, the Mexican reporter Javier Valdez received the International Press Freedom Award from the Committee to Protect Journalists for his coverage of his country's drug trade. Yesterday, he was shot dead for, it seems safe to assume, exactly the same reason. Valdez, who was 50, lived and worked in Sinaloa State, home to the eponymous cartel, widely regarded as the world's richest and most powerful criminal organization. He was at least the fourth journalist killed this year in Mexico, one of the most dangerous countries in the world for reporters. Robin, is there all that much doubt about the prime suspects here?
No, none at all. I mean, journalists who work in Mexico know exactly what the risks are and where the risks come from, and they live with them day in and day out, and I have the utmost respect for them. I have reported from Mexico on several occasions, and I've met some of these guys, and I remember on one occasion a local newspaper editor in Cancun taking me from what he called tourist Cancun to what he called Mexican Cancun, which is a very different city and is rife with drugs cartels. And he took me in his car to a place where just a week previously a journalist had been murdered. I was somewhat nervous about being taken there, to be honest, but he said he was convinced we'd be okay. These guys are heroes. They are absolute heroes because they know what the risks are and they carry on doing it. And those of us who live much more comfortable lives as journalists, I think, need to remember the kind of risks these guys run.
Indeed so. Michael, this, I realise as I ask that it sounds like a silly or glib question, but it's actually not. Why would a drug cartel fear bad press? They're a drug cartel. What are they actually expecting? Good reviews?
Well, I think that the drug cartels, from what we've known about them, I mean, first of all, in Sinaloa, I mean, Senor Valdez, I think, may have been involved in digging up information that, you know, led to Chapo Guzman's ultimate capture and deportation to the U.S. And that's a sin that would never be forgiven, you know, to the fifth generation, to get all biblical on it. But, you know, the drug cartels, like ISIS, like militias in any unstable country, rule by fear. Civil society must be destroyed, and the press is an essential pillar of civil society. So intimidation, and then for those who they think really have ability, murder, it's almost a logical consequence of rule by fear, which is, of course, how the Sinaloa cartel established itself in that section of Mexico and essentially runs its own, I don't know, it's not a republic, but it is separate from the rest of the country.
It's a state within a state.
You know, Mexico carries on. We have, you know, Donald Trump is going to renegotiate NAFTA. There's business, you know, there's automobiles being manufactured and normal trade goes on. And there's these quadrants of the country that have nothing to do with the rest of the state and where the government cannot extend the rule of law.
I think what the cartels fear is courageous journalists burrowing into their influence networks and revealing which politicians they've corrupted, which judges they have corrupted, which police chiefs they have corrupted, which banks are laundering their cash. This all interferes with their operations and makes life uncomfortable for them. And as Michael says, I mean, if you are running this kind of business, you do rule by fear, and you've got to instill in everybody the conviction that if you cross one of the cartels, you will die. It's as simple as that.
Just to follow that up, Robin, you were talking earlier there about your visits to Mexico and meeting the reporters who are covering this beat. And, of course, one Mexican newspaper this year, Norte de Juarez, announced that it was closing. One of its journalists was reported, Miroslava Breach, and they just decided we cannot go on like this. It isn't worth the risk. I mean, and there is a question here which I guess every reporter who has ever worked in a slightly rickety environment has to ask themselves at some point. When do you decide that it just isn't worth it? I mean, Javier Valdez, a remarkably brave man, obviously, but he's dead at 50. His work has not stopped Mexico's drug business or its drug wars. At what point do you make that call?
Well, I think every reporter makes their own decision. I mean, the guy I'm thinking of in Cancun, I remember asking him whether there were stories which he and his team got hold of, which they then decided not to print. He said, yes, of course. Almost every day there are stories that we don't print because we know if we did, we would be killed. So they make that decision on a day-by-day, perhaps even an hour-by-hour basis, and each one of them, a bit like war correspondents, do I go or do I not go? It's a personal decision, it's a difficult decision, and they have to make it themselves.
I think the other thing to remember is that patriotism is a word that we overuse it. But if you're in one of these areas, if you're of one of these places, this is, you know, you say, this is my country, and I can't allow it. The government can't do anything. And it is actually a patriotic act. And, you know, we, sitting here in London, you know, we don't go to war anymore. Robin and I have covered wars, but we don't put on the uniform, and that's not part of the passage and commitment to our countries. But, you know, in Mexico, there is a kind of low-grade civil war going on between these cartels and the government, and here's a man. And his public statements, which we all had a chance to read today, I mean, he knew that his life would be shorter than it should be. He was well aware, in the same way that, you know, an officer leading his men into combat knows, I have a very good chance of not coming home today. And I think that they do have a kind of patriotic view and desire to do what's right by their country, even at the cost of their lives. And, you know, one can only honor people like this by saying their names. And, you know, earlier on Facebook, I put up a post saying, you know, really, I'd much rather be posting about Javier Valdez than, you know, 15 posts about the idiocy of Donald Trump, because this was a man worth talking about. And his cause is worth, you know, mentioning, you know, that there's this Sinaloa cartel and it's evil, but we don't get a chance to.
I always think when I watch journalism award ceremonies and foreign correspondents and war correspondents are garlanded with honors, we very often forget the men and women who report their own countries, who go home every night knowing that their home could be blown up or they could have their head shot off, and that their families are also at risk. It's a different league of risk that these people run to foreign correspondents who are parachuted in and then go home again.
That is indeed the case. Michael, final thought. You were talking, as was Robin, about how one honours the memory of someone like Javier Valdez. Mexico's president, Enrique Nino Nieto, has called his murder an outrageous crime, which is surely the case. But is there some sort of gesture that someone in Nieto's position could make? Is there any way, and this seems like a possibly crass suggestion, but is there any way that any good can come from the loss of this man?
I don't mean to be brutally cynical, but no. I mean, the Mexican army, uncorrupt, could possibly try and take this on. But, you know, it's such a complicated, embedded problem. I mean, in the end, I mean, what will happen in Mexico? Will you have some kind of process like we've just seen in Colombia after 50 years, where the cartels are, you know, allowed to sort of go get away with their crimes? Can we have some enlightenment in America about usage of drugs so it doesn't feed criminal gangs? Don't know.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Robin Lustig and Michael Goldfarb. Up next, the ongoing efforts to prosecute Britain's former Prime Minister Tony Blair over the Iraq War. Do stay tuned.
Subscribe today to become part of the Monocle family. From product design to the best places to go, Monocle will bring a monthly dose of fresh ideas to your door. Being part of the family also comes with a 10% discount at the shop and online, as well as unlimited access to our online archive. In addition, you will enjoy priority access to selected product collaborations and receive exclusive offers and invitations around the world. Subscriptions start from £55. For more information, visit monocle.com/subscribe.
Thank you. You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Robin Lustig and Michael Goldfarb. Now, one of the many curiosities of the recent turbulence of British politics has been a tentative rejoining of the country's national conversation by Tony Blair, who remains divisive in a possibly unique way, which is to say that he's generally respected by his former political opponents, while widely reviled by adherents of the party for which he won three general elections. There are many reasons for this latter animus, the fact that he won elections, not the least of them, but his participation in the 2003 invasion of Iraq always leads the charge sheet, and now a High Court judge is considering whether a legal ban on prosecuting Blair over the war can be lifted. Robin, the fundamental question first, should it be possible to prosecute Tony Blair, or I guess somebody who occupied his position, over an event like the invasion of Iraq?
Oh yes, without doubt. I think national leaders should be prosecutable for war crimes, for crimes against humanity. It has been done against people like Slobodan Milosevic, Radovan Karadzic in the Balkans, against various African leaders who've been brought up against before international courts. Yes, there is such a thing as international law, and it should be upheld, and national leaders, I think, should be bound by it. Whether Tony Blair and his decision to join the US in the action in Iraq in 2003 is one of them I have some doubts about, to be honest.
Michael, what do you think? And is it your sense that the people who are pursuing Tony Blair are angry with Tony Blair specifically about Iraq, or are they just angry with Tony Blair? And if it wasn't Iraq, they would be pursuing him over something else?
No, it's Iraq, without doubt. And it's a boil that needs to be less for the Labour Party to ever, you know, come back together. It is, you know, it's something that needs, actually it doesn't need. I mean, people need to get over it. I mean, he's gone and he needs to get over it and he should stay away. I mean, I think the two things go together. You get this stuff bubbling up every time he feels compelled to re-enter national life in some way. And there's no amount of telling him, actually, no, nobody wants to hear you. Because...
Do you think that's the case, though? I think in the last year, especially since the Brexit vote and the Corbyn ascendancy, I think there's actually quite a lot of people who are quite happy to hear from
him. Well, maybe on your block, but not on mine. you should come over to Hackney, mate.
I don't know what kind of neighborhood you live in.
No way. I
live in the People's Republic of Leytonstone and Wanstead.
Oh, that's too far east for me. No, I never... That's beyond the Olympic Park. I couldn't possibly go there. Look, the thing with Tony Blair, I think, is to go back to the legal question. You can't prosecute him because he was a better lawyer than anyone, and nothing that came out of his mouth was prosecutable. Every I was dotted, every T was crossed. In terms of, you could say, well, it was a dodgy dossier, but we've seen all of the reports. You know, the chairman of the security people, the JIC, all this stuff, they agreed. Now, the dodgy dossier was wrong. There were no weapons of mass destruction. But, you know, I don't think you can get him on this. And nothing he has said subsequently would condemn himself out of his own mouth, because he's a lawyer.
What a lot of the people who want him prosecuted are relying on is that the military action in Iraq was not authorized by a vote in the UN Security Council. And there's a very simplistic view among a lot of people that a war is illegal unless it has been authorized by the UN Security Council. That, in effect, is the same as saying that unless the five permanent members of that council, which include Russia and China, agree to something, then it's illegal. Automatically. I think Mr. Blair's cardinal error, and the reason that he is so reviled by so many of the people who at one time voted for him, is A, that he has never admitted he was wrong. He has said he regrets all the deaths, but he has never said,
well,
he's
his line's always
being a lawyer, because if he says he's wrong, then
the other thing.
But his line has always been that he made the decision that seemed right with the information that was available to him.
But what other people, including Hillary Clinton, have said was, you know, I made the best judgment that I thought I could make at the time, and in retrospect, I can see I was wrong. He's never said that. The other thing that he has done since he stood down as prime minister, he has made shed loads of money. He has got himself stinking rich, and a lot of people in the Labour Party, particularly on the left of the Labour Party, think that's wrong.
But just to bring it back to Donald Trump, which I hate to do,
the key moment
when I knew he would win the nomination for the Republican Party was in a debate in South Carolina, standing two people down from Jeb Bush, and he turned to Jeb Bush and he said, Iraq was a disaster. And by saying that to George Bush's brother, that it was a big mistake, he lanced a boil. And all these Republicans who were knee-jerk patriots said, that's right, it was a mistake. Blair has never said that, and the boil will remain unlanced till he said, it was a catastrophe.
Well, we must move along finally from the extremely serious to the inordinately trivial, by which I mean we do need to look at avocado news. The generally blameless Mexican fruit has somehow become in recent years an emblem of a certain sort of affected bourgeois lifestyle of colour supplement sophistication and rustic whimsy. It is in the news this week for two related reasons. First, reports from emergency rooms around the world of increases in avocado hand, i.e. injuries self-inflicted while chopping the things. And second, the tactile suggestion by an Australian property tycoon that young folk might be able to afford homes even amid Australia's riotously overheated property market if they spent less money on avocado toast. Robin, first of all, why do we scapegoat the avocado?
I love your choice of stories, Andrew. I really
well, this one, I think we can blame the producer, Rhys James.
Well, let's do that. Yeah, always a good idea to blame producers. What's the avocado done? I like avocados. I eat quite a lot of them. I've never once cut my hand on them. I don't know who these people are who can't use a kitchen knife and emerge unscathed. It's bizarre.
They've obviously watched MasterChef or some cooking show and seen how the chef just kind of whacks that sharp blade into the stone and pulls it out in one go, and they miss, or maybe they're into cutting.
Sad. Yeah,
but you know, it's
say.
Interesting. When I first came to this country, the avocado meant avocado sweet in your toilets. You know that all the china
was color.
Was avocado
right.
Color, and like it was really disliked. And then slowly but surely, the lines of supply improved, and avocado became part of our diets. I think avocado toast is actually probably good.
It is.
You know, and I
many cafes in Melbourne make an absolutely excellent avocado toast.
I mean, we use rye, you know, Swedish rye wheat thins
house. Do you know anybody, Andrew, who has cut their hand trying to slice an avocado?
No,
I have
cut a finger while trying to slice cheese. I can't display the scar.
Things you're prepared to reveal on
this
air,
this is a primarily audio medium. I could perhaps put a photograph of it on Twitter, but I'm obviously not going to do that. But it has acquired this bizarre resonance because it does strike me, and I'll ask you first, Michael, that we would not be discussing, you know, possibly quite serious injuries as a comic item if people had done them any other way. I don't think the remarks by this Australian property developer Tim Gurner would have stung quite as much if he'd made reference to some other frippery that people were throwing
their
money on.
In the 90s, it was latte. Come on. You know, in Melbourne, they were drinking lattes and they could have saved
up. They still are. But which does bring me to my next question, Robin, which is that a massive price hike is expected this year
for avocados due to
the poor harvest and increased demand. So if people get priced out of avocados, what are we going to scapegoat next? What will be regarded as a sort of symbolic?
Have you already forgotten the great hummus scare? I mean, before it was avocados, people like me who pretty much live on hummus, particularly at lunchtime, went into their local supermarket and saw bare shelves with a little sign saying, there is no hummus, very sorry, due to a production issue. That was seriously bad news. If it's not avocado, oh, I don't know what it'll be. Kale seems to be extraordinarily popular in some quarters.
In America, kale has become the new signifier of that class of people. But, you know, with global warming, who needs to import avocados? It would be potted avocados by the window, just as we have them in New York. And you could get a supply going all year long in this country now.
Well, on that self-sufficient note, time is against us. We're all going out for a latte and some kale. Michael Goldfarb and Robin Lustig, thanks for joining us. Whatever kale even actually is, I haven't hadn't quite figured out quinoa. I'm not even sure how
that's... But you know how to say it.
Is that how it's pronounced? Yeah. Well, that is a happy accident. We've learned something today. But that is all for today's Midori House. It was produced by Rhys James, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Christian Radev. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Jamie Waters and Henry Rhys Sheridan are in with Section D at 1900, and I'll be back with more on the day's main stories on the Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Good evening.